We're sorry. Due to telephone company facility trouble, your call cannot be completed at this time. Will you try your call again later? Thank you.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. And I'm Anvil staying here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Hello, everyone.
And out in Signal Land, we have Alex.
You do indeed. Good evening.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
And Gila.
Good evening.
Well, a reminder. Some people might think this is the week that we do the call-in show, and it usually is, but we decided to move it back 1 week. We were having phone issues on our overtime program that airs on YouTube at 8 o'clock. So next week at this time on WBAI, we will be taking phone calls. So mark your calendars. We will be open to all our listeners who have something to say, and always something to look forward to. So 5 week gap this time, not a 4 week gap. So everybody adjust your calendars. All right, you know, I like to think I'm the cool person that still listens to what the kids have to say, you know, and tries to understand the music and tries to, you know, treat everybody as if you know, we all have the same knowledge and background and things like that. Try to keep an open mind, in other words, you know. I think we all strive for that, but you know, it's hard sometimes. It's difficult. So across the country, parents are being warned about an internet trend that has students setting their school-issued Chromebooks on fire. Yeah, it's a trend. It's a TikTok trend.
Challenge.
What's the challenge? You do it and it's done. Yeah, okay, so school districts all across the country, you can list all the states in the nation here, there's no point. They've been issuing all sorts of warnings, reports from school districts, and videos, according to Ars Technica. The so-called Chromebook Challenge includes students sticking things into Chromebook ports to short-circuit the system. Students are using easily accessible items to do this, including writing utensils. I believe they're known as pens, paper clips, gum wrappers, push pins. Do you guys have some more to add? No?
Not in my Chromebooks, no.
I thought you had your hand up. You wanted to add some items to that.
Oh, no. It's
okay. Well, you know, I could think of, thumbtacks, nails, anything metallic really will work. You know, bits of aluminum foil, perhaps?
A fork,
that's a good one, yeah.
Yeah, did you already say gum wrapper?
And it's a Swiss Army knife, yeah, there's a bunch of things.
Pitchfork?
There's guaranteed to be something around the house, or around your school, that'll work. So, guys, I'm trying. Okay, the scissors. Okay, in Plainview, Connecticut. Plainville, Connecticut. I'm not sure why this one's getting attention. A middle schooler allegedly intentionally stuck scissors into a laptop, causing smoke to emit from it. That's according to Superintendent Brian Reese, who is getting national attention because he caught the kid doing it. That incident reportedly led to one student going to the hospital due to smoke inhalation, and it's suspected to be connected to the viral trend. Well, unless it started the viral trend, I'm not sure why this poor middle school student is getting all the attention here. Apparently they're sending him to juvenile court. Wow, that's the most unlucky kid in the world. So everybody's setting their Chromebooks on fire, and this one poor middle schooler in Connecticut is taking the heat for it all. TikTok has banned the search term Chromebook Challenge. I'm not exactly sure how you ban a search term, but they're doing it. Searching for the term brings up a message that reads as follows. Your safety matters. Some online challenges can be dangerous, disturbing, or even fabricated. Learn how to recognize harmful challenges so you can protect your health and well-being. The message includes a link to a page telling users how to assess challenges on the platform. TikTok has said that the Chromebook Challenge is on other social media platforms as well, and maybe they don't block it. Google did not respond to Ars Technica's request for comment because they don't respond to anybody. It's not the first dangerous internet sensation closely associated with TikTok, in case anyone's been asleep. In 2022, for example, TikTok helped catapult the Kia Challenge. Does anybody remember the Kia Challenge? No? Oh, let me tell you about the Kia Challenge. That led to uprisings. Uprisings is the wrong word, I think. an uprising sounds like something exciting. No, basically, more Kia and Hyundai thefts, an increase in Kia and Hyundai thefts, as well as a $200 million class action lawsuit settlement from the car manufacturers. I'm not exactly sure what that was all about. There was also the Blackout Challenge, where people tried to choke themselves until they lost consciousness. And the fire challenge, where people poured flammable liquids on themselves and then set the liquids on fire. Okay, you know, at some point, you gotta accede to the Darwin challenge and say, you know what, if you're going to pour something flammable on yourself and light a match, I don't think anyone else really deserves the blame for that. And if you try to choke yourself until you lose consciousness, that's on you. It's not on whoever sold you whatever bit of equipment you used to do that. This is just insane. And it's not just young people either. I don't want to give the impression that the Chromebook Challenge is taking place in schools. So that one is pretty much. I don't think you see a lot of corporate executives going around setting their Chromebooks on fire. I don't think you see a lot of corporate executives using Chromebooks because, they're kind of useless. Anyway, parents and psychiatrists have been trying to wrap their heads around how some of the more dangerous internet trends take off, especially among kids. A viewpoint published by a pair of University of Tennessee Health Science Center at Memphis psychiatrists in JAMA Psychiatry, boy, I got lost in that sentence, back in November, highlighted the complexities of trying to decipher if children who participate in such risky TikTok trends are looking to hurt themselves. TikTok challenges are an emerging public health concern for children, the psychiatrist write. I would say it's probably more about getting attention, about gaining popularity, about all those things, you know, that that social media bring to us, all those unhealthy desires. And if it involves setting yourself on fire or blowing up your computer, you'll take that risk. It's really insane and crazy, but that is our society right now. Rob?
Yeah, this story was fascinating to me because I'm about 100 years old now, but I remember being a kid in school and wanting to damage things or break things or leave a mark on things. You know, I doodled in textbooks, and knowing the school district I went to, those textbooks are probably still being used. But the fact of doing this with a Chromebook A, it's expensive, and you're obviously going to be charged for it, or your parents or guardians are, or whatever, and that's no good. It's physically dangerous. You know, lithium batteries are nothing to mess with. But also, you're being handed a computer, and yeah, it's a Chromebook, it's a piece of garbage, but you can still put things into those computers that are much more subversive and useful. Things like, you know, open source software, things like alternative operating systems. You know, if you want to tinker with one of these things, you know, jailbreak it. Do something else that will give you a tool that you could, you know, maybe do some more fun stuff with. Put Wireshark on it, I don't know. But, you know, just breaking it to break it, that's kind of devoid of imagination.
Yeah, you know, graffiti was a big deal when I was going to school. And graffiti looks pretty damn good right about now because, you know, you're expressing yourself. You're sending a message. You're being creative, artistic. And here you're just destroying. You know, it would be like you get a textbook for a class and you rip it up. And now you don't have a textbook anymore. And you haven't really accomplished anything except to deprive yourself of a resource. And, you know, it might be a bit spectacular to have something smoke and go on fire for a little bit. But after the thrill wears off and after about a million people do it, I just don't see what the appeal is. And I honestly can't figure this out. Alex, you have a kid. Is he doing things like this? Can he explain it?
I can't really explain this other than the fact that I think it goes back
to... You can't explain it. I'm asking if he can explain it.
Oh, if he can explain it. He might be able to explain this probably. I would imagine he can probably explain it better than I could, or at least he could attempt to explain it better than I could. So, you know, perhaps we can have him on maybe next week or the week thereafter or something, and he can talk about this type of idiocy that we're seeing. But I think this really goes back to what I've said time and time again now, probably for the last decade on this show, that social media is just a scourge on this society, that is dangerous, that it really can affect impressionable children, especially at this young age, and cause them to do really idiotic things. I think it psychologically distorts them in so many ways, gets them in trouble, causes them to do this type of idiotic activity. But what's also really concerning to me here as well, Emmanuel, is that the criminal charges that are levied against these kids in Connecticut could have really long-term implications for them. It could limit their education options. It could limit their employment options. It could prevent these children who might otherwise be really talented and smart and could have a promising career from doing something, perhaps even with the U.S. government, being charged with an arson offense.
Alex, you're literally saying it's going to go on their permanent record. How do you think a kid is going to react to you saying that?
Yeah, well, that's a big problem, right? Because they don't even understand the implications of what a permanent record is when their prefrontal lobes are. So
well, you can tell yourself they don't understand, or you can tell yourself they don't care. You know, either way, they're pushing back. But I think you touched upon something really important here, as far as this being indicative of social media and the stupidity that social media leads us into. Now, this is a very blatant example, you know, literally lighting your own computer on fire. But there are so many other examples of stupid things people do based on what they're told on social media. And I think we just have to look around us in everyday news to see the results of that. You know, the kids are kind of showing us the absurdity. But what we are doing every single day as adults is far, far worse than lighting Chromebooks on fire. And we don't seem to see that. I mean, we see that, but as a society, I don't think that it's really hit us yet that, boy, we are screwing ourselves up tremendously based on what we are being told on social media. And I just wonder, when is that realization gonna hit? Because I think the kids are going to get it at some point. They're going to realize, oh, yeah, this probably isn't the best thing to do. You know, it takes a few months maybe for that to that knowledge to set in. But, you know, for us that are you know, tearing apart democracy and seeing everything that we cherish and value fall apart based on lies and falsehoods and all kinds of disinformation, you know, that's going to take a lot longer. And I just wish we could speed it up. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, I will tell you, too, you know, Sasha, my son, is very skeptical of social media. I think he approaches it with a very, very large grain of salt. And I think he has a very mature understanding of the danger and the implications of social media, and he really wants nothing to do with it. And I think that's a great sign, or really a propitious start here for this generation. I think to approach social media with this sense of danger and trepidation, I think it's great. So I would love to have him come back on and talk about this, but I think that these challenges are really just incredibly stupid, right? And it reminds me of when we were younger, and I was, you know, a hacker and a phone freak, and we used to try to cause people on the other end of phones to do stupid things. Right? We'd call like the Encore operator and pretend that, you know, we were tech support and that their computer was overheating, and so you would cause them to pour some kind of liquid into the back of the computer, or you'd do that with McDonald's or something. You know, there were all these types of social engineering tricks where phone freaks used to get people on the other end of the phone to do really ridiculous things. But now with social media, these challenges have enabled people to do this en masse, across countries, across borders. It's really kind of incredible when you think about it.
You know, you mentioned the Encore operator person who answered the phone at Encore, a long-distance company. And there was one story that someone told me at some point. I don't think it was you. You had your own stories, but they got the Encore operator to get their computer to go all the way down to a C prompt. And at that point, they just sort of left them. And it's just, you know, it's told in fables what happened beyond that point. But you could get people to do almost anything. And it's, you know, social engineering. And, yeah, some people consider that to be harmful or malicious. But I don't think it holds a candle to what we're seeing today as far as this kind of destructiveness. Go ahead, Gila.
It's not. And, I mean, excuse me, I think the fact that people used to have the ability to social engineer and to do all these things, but to work it out in the privacy of their own situation and not expect to share it with the known universe. And I think about the things that are becoming TikTok trends are also ludicrous. And that's kind of what I don't understand. TikTok confuses me. I know I'm an old curmudgeon. I do not understand. But was it last week where some kid who was doing a TikTok trend ding dong ditch and got shot?
Mm-hmm. What the hell is ding dong ditch?
Emmanuel, this has been a thing forever. You walk up to somebody, you ring their doorbell, and you run away. Ding dong ditch. Are you?
That's it? People have been doing that since before doorbells were invented.
Exactly, but apparently it's now a TikTok trend, and a young person did it and ditched the wrong ding-dong, apparently, and
got shot in pursuit
of TikTok love.
The issue here is not TikTok. The issue here is why some maniac is shooting people who ring his doorbell or her doorbell.
I think it's an interest. I think it's both, honestly. But the idea that you're just... Yeah, what happened to just making prank phone calls on random people? Like, when my dad was in high school, he managed to social engineer a traffic jam on the other side of the city. He called the radio station and started getting fake traffic updates and caused a rubberneck traffic jam all by himself.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. And that's awesome, and no one knows about it because he didn't talk about it a lot. But
statute of limitations. It's,
that's also true.
Nobody really knows.
But, you know, where is the line of clout? And when you have kids, and especially kids who have been fed into the social media ecosystem by their parents, all these family TikTok channels and family YouTube channels and family whatevers, and they do not understand that not every single thing you do has to be for public consumption. And where is that space to be a kid and mess around and do dumb things and not do it for public consumption?
You know, it's interesting that you say that because there is so much surveillance now that you really can't do dumb things without immediately being called to account. And yet, people are doing dumber things than ever en masse. And, you know, I don't know which to cheer for, people who are spitting in the face of authority or, you know, people who are stopping the lunacy from continuing. But, you ask why people aren't making prank phone calls anymore. People aren't making phone calls anymore. That's why. If we made more phone calls, I dare say we'd probably be making more prank phone calls as well. Go ahead, Rob.
So I'm going to push back a little on the idea that social media is a scourge and that all these challenges are destructive because, you know, as an adult, I get a lot out of social media. I enjoy my current social media environment in the spots and venues where I choose to participate. And there are challenges out there that are fun. There are challenges out there that won't break things. One example, I'm actually participating in a social media challenge that lasts all month, and it is something that was arranged by a Muppet fan site. We all love the Muppets. And it is just a list of art prompts. It's a daily art challenge, you know, draw a different character or situation from the Muppet universe every single day. And so a bunch of fans will throw in together on this, and everyone will draw their own take on it and post it. And I've been having a lot of fun with that. It's, you know, helped with a little artist block that I was dealing with before that. Gila actually turned me onto this and let me know that it was happening. And there are these fun challenges like that. You know, you go back a generation or so now on social media, and there was the ice bucket challenge where people were dumping ice water over themselves or not, but it was to raise money for charity, and that was fun. There are challenges out there, and there are uses for social media that can be fun, that can be okay, and that, you know, as long as we question and continuously question the place of these things in our lives, and rather than hanging too much on it and, you know, tying things to our success or failure with it, just using it as the toy that it is and as the, you know, networking tool that it is. But, you know, having a little awareness around what you decide to do with it. And when you're a kid and you haven't quite, you know, gotten your grasp of consequences and things of, like, say, setting your school-issued computer on fire, I think that's when it's more dangerous. That's when it can be a lot more destructive. And that's when I think I am constantly grateful that my own childhood predated the modern social media era, because I know I would have ended up doing really idiotic things and having them out there forever versus being able to do idiotic things and have everyone forget about them because I was a kid at the time.
Yes, Alex.
Yeah, I mean, who knew Rob T. Firefly was so wholesome? I had no idea over there. You know, drawing Muppets and all kinds of fun things. I had no clue, Rob. But
you followed me on social media.
I guess that could be it. But I mean, I see your point there, though. But I think it goes back to, and I think you really underscored the issue here, is that, you know, while social media might not be dangerous to a well-rounded adult like yourself, it certainly is dangerous to children because they're so impressionable and they're likely to do stupid things. I mean, are we going to see the next challenge have to do with, like, bloodletting or something? Are we going to wait until kids exsanguinate themselves on social media, you know, before we put an end to this kind of thing? I mean, I really think I'm not really in favor of more governmental regulation. I think that the best defense, as I've said many, many times on the show, against disinformation and idiocy is the gray matter that we have in between our brains. But I do think that when that gray matter is inhibited, as it may be with children up to a certain age, that it's just not a good idea for them to have unfettered access to social media.
Yeah, but, you know, you say that kids are impressionable, and they are. It's particularly dangerous because, you know, they're young and innocent, but we're all impressionable and we're all doing stupid things. And, I think we need to cast a wider net as to, you know, how we conduct ourselves and what it is that we are looking for. For instance, you know, I would advise anyone, on social media, ignore the popularity, lure that they throw in front of you. Because it shouldn't be about that. It shouldn't be about just getting popular. It should be about doing something different, being yourself, and not worrying so much about whether or not you're trendy. And the other thing I would say would be to never put somebody down for doing things different or for being different, or for, you know, being strange or just something that you're not familiar with. All of those things happen constantly on social media, and it's what makes it such a negative environment when it could be a very positive environment. Sure, you know, when these platforms started, there was nothing but optimism for what they could do, and they certainly have done some good things as well. But it all gets eclipsed by the negative if people are hurting themselves or losing all their self-confidence or just buying into things that aren't worth anything in the long run. That's what we have to look at. And to say that it's just kids that need to be protected, look, we need to protect ourselves. We don't need some overseer to, you know, lay down the law and tell us what to do and what not to do. None of us like that, whether it's a government or whether it's Google. Nobody likes that. But we need to have some common sense. We need to learn. And, you know, you learn things. You learn how to ride a bike. You learn to wear a helmet. You learn, you know, this is good. If you don't do this, it's irresponsible. And Darwin takes care of the rest, like I said before. And so it's something I think we can't let that conversation stop, because it's super important that we look out for each other. And that goes for us as individuals. That goes for us as an entire society. That goes for the entire world.
I think there's an example here, too, that for all the reasons it is positive to have these platforms, they can very affordably be manipulated and leveraged in ways that are harmful. And that's something that's been around as a sentiment from the earliest roots of this technology. And my hope is people have a little more reverence for their hardware, the stuff that's facilitating their own learning, and perhaps even a teacher will turn this into a curriculum on the science of short-circuiting batteries and how this, or how challenge culture can be harmful. You know, there's a lot of lessons here to take away from these challenges and possibly turn some good into this, and have maybe students will have a better understanding of, like, hazardous materials and the engineering behind some of these devices.
Well, as far as I see, the only reason to set your Chromebook on fire is to look cool in the eyes of others. And when this many people are doing it, nobody's looking cool anymore. So let's move on to something else, and let's us move on to something else as well. You might have heard of this charter airline called Global X. They are an airline used for deportations by the U.S. government, and according to this Register story, actually according to a lot of stories, Global Crossing Airlines Group on May 5th learned of unauthorized activity within its computer networks and systems supporting portions of its business applications, which the company determined to be the result of a cybersecurity incident. Yes, upon learning of this activity, the company immediately activated its incident response protocols and third-party cybersecurity experts to assist with containment and mitigation activities and to investigate the nature and scope of the incident, and took actions to contain and isolate the affected servers and prevent further intrusion. The nature of the incident is not yet known, but the popular blueprint for cyber criminals who gain access to a company is to exfiltrate data and use it as leverage to extort. So the alleged perpetrators have basically pitched the news that they have stolen flight records and passenger manifests, including ones related to deportation flights. They've pitched that news to various news outlets, and the timing of that disclosure, its ambiguous wording, suggests there is at least some truth to the story. Global X was quickly identified as one of the main small airlines whose services were called upon by ICE within days of Trump taking office for the second time, although the company doesn't openly advertise this. I'm kind of curious how they get the word out. Bloomberg reported that some of the earliest flights it was tasked with making from the U.S. to South American countries, such as Brazil, Colombia, Guatemala, and Honduras, were mired in technical difficulties. The airline operates a fleet of 19 Airbus planes, A320s, 321s, and 321Fs. They reportedly tackled various issues, ranging from aborted landings, broken air conditioning leading to deportees fainting from high temperatures, to not being able to start engines for hours. Oh, yeah, real first class here. According to its investor presentation, Global X is the fastest growing charter airline in America. But up-to-date filing show it has yet to turn a profit since being founded in 2018. You know, I just want to say, if this airline is being hacked, if any airline that is helping with deportation is being hacked, I think that's a good thing. And I think that's something that is a patriotic duty of people to find out just what's going on, because we're sure as hell not getting the details. And if you have flight manifests, that is extremely valuable information. Because many times people who are being sent to El Salvador or other places are not having their whereabouts told to their loved ones, to their friends, relatives, anyone. And it's you know, like a one of those situations that you hear about in places you never think would be anywhere near where we are now. You know, third world countries where human rights abuses are you know, the routine. That is the kind of thing that we are looking at. So anyone who fights that, anyone who is able to crack the armor a little bit and get some details out, get some information out, that is a good thing. You know, ransomware, no, not for this. This is too important. This is something that really needs to be shared, and we need to find out who is being sent where and exactly why. Alex?
I don't think I entirely agree with that, Emmanuel, and here's the reason why. I mean, I can understand the sentiment and kind of the sympathy here with respect to this form of civil disobedience being a way to essentially throw some sand into the gears of this operation, this deportation operation that the Trump administration has been that's been ongoing for some time now, and I think is really quite serious and quite dangerous as well. But I don't necessarily agree with the hacktivists here who released the information publicly, because we're dealing with people who were arguably seeking political asylum. A lot of these people were migrants. They might have been fleeing violence or some kind of political persecution, and putting their identities out there, letting the whole world know that they have been sent back to their home countries from which they fled to the United States and have now been deported back to where they came, I think it's going to heighten their risk of violence, of retaliation. I think if there is a breach of this sort, and I'm all in favor of civil disobedience, and you know my stance on that, I think you know, civil disobedience also should be public and have some kind of punishment associated with it as well. I think that kind of completes the act. But I think that you have to be extraordinarily careful about the data of these migrants and the sensitivities that these people have with respect to this deportation. This could really stigmatize them for the rest of their lives as well.
Well, you're assuming that the people being sent back to the country that they came from, and that somehow they're being sent back is not being shared with the authorities in that particular country. I think they already know who's coming back, people who tried to flee their regime. If there's a shipment of people being sent back to them, they're going to know who those people are. And if they're being sent to a third country like El Salvador, a country that they've never even been to before, to a maximum security prison, I'm pretty sure the people who are being sent there would want the world to know what's happening to them. Because if they're going to be in that prison, and it is a prison where that advertises that nobody ever walks out of here, nobody ever leaves unless they're in a casket, that kind of sick society that they find themselves in, you know, I think you're already in hell at that point, and having your name, basically shared with people so that people know what became of you and where you are, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that is a service to people who are looking for justice.
Well, I think we're both making assumptions here, and maybe some of them are erroneous assumptions, but I think if we're right about even a small case of them, I think it's wise to really curate this data. But one point I think you missed was that it's not necessarily always the government that these people have been fleeing. When they're fleeing violence or fleeing persecution, it's not necessarily associated with some kind of despotic regime. It could have to deal with a cartel. It could have to deal with some kind of private violence that is endemic wherever they live. They could have a, you know, armed gangs, militias, these people that are, they're fleeing. And a lot of these people, especially from Central America, have fled such absolutely horrific, not only, I think, political violence, but, you know, this kind of personal vendettas that have been sought after families and things, you know, gang rapes and absolutely horrific factual situations that don't necessarily involve the government. In fact, a lot of these cartels and these kind of organized criminal enterprises are, you know, at loggerheads with the government, so they're not necessarily going to be sharing that information as well. So I think we have to not just think of it in the sense of, well, a government's already going to know. The fact that these people are coming back on a plane and where they're going to be located, or if they are going into some kind of facility like a prison, I think that puts them at really, really great risk.
Yeah, but people are going to find out they're there. If they're in a prison, their name is going to be spread around the whole prison. So, you know, you're not going to be able to stay anonymous in that situation very long. And if you're going back to another country where the cartel, you know, rules the streets, I'm not sure how you're going to hide from them when you were trying to flee from them in the first place. It just seems, you know, like this is a way to not get something done, to not get word out, to not gum up the works a bit. And I think at this point, where so many people are being victimized by this, there has to be some kind of an action where people do something to fight back. Because right now, it's that there's really nothing. There's so little. So something like this, and you call it civil disobedience. I think we've done enough civil disobedience. I think it's just time for regular disobedience at this point. Basically just getting out there and letting them know that this will not stand. I think that's the message that needs to be sent. And will it be perfect? No, of course not. There'll be, you know, rough edges. But just sitting back and letting it happen and filing appeals and writing nasty letters, it's not enough. Rob?
One angle about this story that is making me think a lot is the idea that Global X, a private company, is, you know, I generally don't approve. In fact, I always don't approve of fascism. I don't approve of private enterprise that aids fascism. And the idea that a company that is participating in this, that, you know, bid for the job and got it and is enthusiastically doing it, having to be afraid of people finding out that they're doing it, having to be afraid that they're going to be held accountable in the public sphere, having to be afraid that the name Global X is, you know, going to become synonymous with, you know, papers, please, brown shirts in, you know, in just the whole sphere of all that's going on. The idea of them having to fear that sort of thing and that sort of thing happening to them kind of makes me very happy. I am not going to sit here and tell anyone to do anything that's against the law because that would be wrong. But the fact of things like this happening, I got to say, it gives me a bit of a warm feeling.
Yes, Alex.
You know, I'm curious about what the implications are going to be with respect to Global X here, because in any other situation, an airline would face some kind of regulatory scrutiny. There'd be some calls in Congress to hail their executives before some kind of committee and have them testify about their cybersecurity posture and why it was so lax. But what's really kind of fascinating to me here, too, is that the aggrieved individuals are people who have been deported here. So what are the data breach notification obligations with respect to those individuals, right? They're not necessarily within the United States anymore. They were within the United States. They might have been en route outside of it at that particular time. But they certainly have a great nexus to the United States because it's the country from which they were deported.
Alex, can I just stop you right there? Our country is thinking of suspending habeas corpus for these people. Do you think they're going to notify them if their private data was breached?
Well, here's my thought on this, too. Their rights were compromised in some way, infringed upon by Global X, right, that allowed this incident to occur, and that resulted in the release of their personally identifiable information, the flight manifest, et cetera, that could, for all the reasons that I detailed before, subject them to political persecution, violence, et cetera. So wouldn't it be interesting if those people banded together and filed their own class action lawsuit, and I think that they would have the right to do so, but if they could file their own class action suit, likely in California, against Global X for this particular data breach. I think that would be really interesting, and I'd love to see what would shake out in the discovery portion of that.
Which people are you referring to?
The people that were deported, the people whose data was released by the hacktivists.
How are they going to do this in a prison in El Salvador?
Well, they wouldn't have to do this. They would have to find counsel, obviously, to file a lawsuit on their behalf. And I'd be surprised if there wasn't some enterprising plaintiff's lawyer somewhere who was already scheming up a class action on the basis of this breach.
Yeah, but hopefully they're cooking up something, a class action on behalf of them being seized and thrown out of the country and put into a horrible subhuman prison that they have no hope of escaping from. You know,
I think that's
priority. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, no doubt. But you know, look, we've seen what our government and this particular administration has done in terms of lifting fingers to help people who were wrongly deported. So, you know, I wouldn't hold their breath.
Well, no, you're not going to depend on the government to do anything. You have to fight them and do it yourself. And that's where we should be focusing our attention. Anyway, we have to move on. We have some listener mail. Actually, this comes from an old friend of ours. You guys remember the name David Dolphin, who was on this show way back in before 2010, I think. Hello, friends. It has been 5,971 days since – actually, this came in a week ago, so hang on. It's been 5,978 days since I was last on the show. And I'm not going to check his math, but wow. I must first apologize for having startled Emmanuel on that Berlin rooftop, causing him to drop his phone, which disconnected the call. You can hear the shenanigans in the archive, December 31st, 2008. Okay, I'll take your word for that, too. I love listening to Off the Hook, but I had to write concerning your March 19th discussion regarding self-driving cars. See, everyone's listening. People listen out there. Might not be on the radio anymore, but they still listen to the show. Wow, 5,978 days. You're absolutely right to be skeptical of Tesla's self-driving system. Studies show that even when Teslas are updated to the latest software version, the system will disengage, requiring the driver to take over control every 230 miles on average. This is better than the 110 miles per disengagement last year, but still shockingly bad. A lack of LIDAR and radar sensors, for cost reasons, is limiting the Tesla autonomous system, leading to fatal crashes every few months. However, just because Tesla FSD is a deficient system, unfit for our public roads, does not mean all self-driving systems are as bad. Waymo has been shown to disengage once per 10,000 miles, and Zoox's, I've never said that word before, Z-O-X, Zoox. Zoox's disengagement rate is once per 28,000 miles, more than 120 times better than Tesla. As a parent and cyclist in San Francisco, congratulations, I find that Waymos are some of the safest drivers on the road. They always drive at or below the speed limit. They give me space in the bike lane. They come to a complete stop at intersections. They pull over for emergency vehicles and have far better reaction speeds than a typical driver. You can look at videos of Waymo avoiding running over a motorcyclist who crashed in front of the car, or Waymo braking to avoid being hit by a red light runner. In both of these situations and many others, human drivers would have fared worse, resulting in injuries or death. It is right to question new technology, especially in safety-critical situations like driving, but Waymos have now traveled tens of millions of miles, and the data is showing that they are 85 to 90% safer than human drivers. Traffic collisions are the leading cause of death for children in the USA, surpassing gun deaths. Moving toward competent self-driving systems will save countless lives inside and outside the car. Waymo's announcement last week that they are partnering with Toyota to bring their autonomous driving software to cars you can own is a wonderful step in this direction. I hope Waymo's come to New York City soon so you can all experience how their system works, but please avoid Tesla self-driving at all costs. Your life may depend on it. All the best, David Dolphin. David, great to hear from you. And good points. You know, I will never argue that autonomous cars are generally safer drivers than the average person, because boy, we have some terrible drivers. We really do. But when something goes wrong with autonomous cars, it can really go wrong. And there may not be examples involving Waymos, but we certainly have heard of things with others. And also, I guess our imagination kind of carries us away as well. If there is an accident involving autonomous cars, it may be one accident, and if a human was driving, there could have been 50 accidents for that one, but we hear about the one because it's autonomous. I still, driving is something that I think is a human thing, but I get that a lot of people probably shouldn't be driving. I hope that we reach some kind of parity where, there's a number of people who are equipped to drive, who are safe drivers, but also autonomous drivers who are also safe. If we get the unsafe autonomous vehicles off the road and the unsafe human drivers off the road, then I think everyone gets what they want. Thoughts?
I'm glad that these points were raised to just distinguish that not all of these systems are the same, that it is a marketplace and different things are out there and evolving and improving, which is, as you said, the goal. That's the public good of this technology, that that altogether we have a lot more capable vehicles and systems augmenting drivers of vehicles. So there's tools if you're driving yourself that enhance your senses as a driver and your reaction times and acumen behind the wheel, but also improving and ever better systems that themselves use the same caution in automated ways. That would be the hope, is that big machines on the roadways are as safe as they could possibly be. So, yeah, it's not all doom, I guess, and we should be hopeful for those things.
It's just, we've seen technology screw up so many times. And when you think, an 18-wheeler is barreling down the highway and it's a computer and no human, you kind of get terrified as to what could happen. And I think that kind of defines who we are, people who are terrified about what could happen. It probably will be an improvement in the human drivers who are out there. Truck drivers excluded, though, because they always are, in my experience, fairly safe on the interstates, at least. But I could see some things going horribly wrong, and I just worry about what we have to sacrifice in order to learn. But again, what we have right now is certainly nothing to write home about. There's so many bad drivers on the road and so much carnage on the highways. So anything that improves that, it's a good thing. Any thoughts? Alex?
Yeah, I think I'm more aligned with you on this one, Emmanuel. As somebody who's coded quite a bit in his life, I just think there are so many goddamn variables that exist when you're driving a car that would be so difficult to account for in any way with some kind of, universal program, some kind of self-driving program. I just don't trust it. I don't trust the people who have coded these systems. I know they're tested and tried and lots of ways, but I don't necessarily think that a lot of this code is out there for public scrutiny or is open source. And if it was, I would feel a little bit more comfortable, perhaps getting behind the wheel, so to speak, of a self-driving car. But until then, I think, there's a reason why I don't have, electronic locks and things on my house. I like to turn a key. I like to shift a gear. I like to be behind the wheel and be in control. And I just don't think that society is ready just yet to hand it all over to machines, whether we're talking about artificial intelligence or some kind of self-driving car. I think there is merit to having the so-called humans in the loop here.
I don't even trust cruise control. I stay away from that. I want to be in control even at that, on the long, lonely stretches on the highway. I want to be able to determine. And it's stupid, too, because, I'd never get a speeding ticket if I just kept it at a certain speed and it was constant. But I don't know. I want to be engaged, I think that's something that people who drive and are passionate about it can understand. Kyle, I know you're one of those people.
Oh, yeah. I like to drive a lot, but there are limitations, and you have to practice it, and you're always, every time you get behind the wheel, you're always older than you were the last time you were behind the wheel. You have to kind of remember to give yourself time, give yourself and patience, and I don't know, all the opportunities to have a safe driving experience. But I am interested in a lot of the things that we're able to do with technology in those environments in ways that aren't distracting. So, yeah, I like, and I'm not necessarily in vehicles that have all of those things. Sometimes I'm in vehicles that are very minimal. So, I bring that sense to it and take that drive maybe a little bit more seriously because you're in a vehicle that can't withstand the kind of driving you would get away with something chock full of it, you know?
The simple vehicles, I think, are the best. I was in a rental car the other day, and I was just trying to tune the radio while I was driving. Do you know it's impossible? Because you can't just reach over and tune it. You have to look at it. You have to read it. You have to enter numbers. It's insane. Whoever designs these things is out to kill us because it makes no sense whatsoever. You just want to be able to tune from one frequency to the next. You know, a simple, and you can't even do that because if there isn't a strong enough signal, it'll skip right over. All right, so you have to enter it by hand, but that means you can't be looking at the road, and you just wind up not listening to the radio. And the whole thing is so incredibly stupid. And old analog radios really are the best thing to have in that kind of situation. Hey, we're out of time. That went fast. But we're going to continue the conversation and take phone calls on YouTube at 8 o'clock. Go to channel 2600 on YouTube or the link on the front page at 2600.com. A reminder, next week from 7 to 8, we will be taking phone calls for the WBAI audience. And we hope you can join us then as well. In the meantime, please support WBAI because this station is what makes it all possible. And yeah, people are calling already. It's an amazing place where so many different voices can be heard, and so much free speech is shared over 99.5 FM. Go to buddy.wbai.org. Do I have that right, Gila? Okay.
That's correct.
And pledge whatever you can afford to keep WBAI on the air for another 65 years. That would be great. All right, write to us, OTH at 2600.com. We'll see you next week. Good night.